Francesco, welcome back.
Very happy to be here again with a new year. So 2026 seems so. The AI here, I would say, or probably has been like the last 3 or 4 years already. But this one it will be another AI really tough year. And even if I'm not used to talk about AI, I will briefly talk about it in relation to a few things I'm working recently. So that seems completely unrelated, but they really are not. So
I'm also glad you are back because you are the only breakdancer on my podcast so far.
Probably the only one survived to breakdance because that, you know,
it's so dangerous.
It's pretty dangerous. I mean, I'm a tall guy, relatively tall, so like 190 centimeter. So
wow.
I'm pretty tough. I'm pretty tall as a breakdancer, so I'm very lucky that I can still talk, actually.
Okay.
The smaller one, you know, is better when they do breakdance. But the taller one, not really, so it's pretty tough.
So you're almost a basketball, you know.
I'm a kind of a cliche when we talk about the street related sport, because I was doing 3-on-3 basketball and dunk competition when I was much younger. So I have been into the basketball thing, and I knew Kobe Bryant when Kobe Bryant was in Italy for one of the contests, the dunk contest, and he was one of the judges during the competition. So it was interesting.
So you were the judge?
No. It was Kobe Bryant. So that now he is a very famous basketball player that sadly has died a few years ago.
Okay.
And even if it was US, he basically grew up in Sicily, if I remember correctly.
Oh.
And so he was able to speak Italian. I didn't know at that time. I was like 16 years old.
Okay.
And during the dunk competition, she just say, ciao, Francesco. And I say, oh, so you speak Italian. It's not just ciao, or it would be something more. I'm actually can talk Italian. It was pretty nice.
So, you won the competition.
I didn't win the competition because I wasn't the smaller one able to dunk. So I was decently tall. The dunk was good. But one guy that was much smaller was capable to jump as high as me. And that was pretty impressive to the judge.
Was it Spud Webb? You know Spud Webb?
Spud Webb, yeah, exactly. So there are people like that. They have incredibly genetics and mix it with hard work and they just jump, you know, incredibly high. No.
Mm-hmm.
For me, no. It was just because it was tall.
Very good. So now to the back to the boring topics or more exciting topics. AI. You found ChatGPT on the internet, you told me, and they would like to talk about this, right?
Yeah. Now, I have to be honest, it's slightly related to the main topic that is related virtual threads, actually. Because since I'm working on a very specific feature that we don't know yet if it's going to into the JDK, OpenJDK mainline, because it's still a very R&D kind of work.
Okay.
It will probably go there. And I built my own repository on GitHub, working on that one. And for once in my life, I say, let me use all the fancy AI stuff I could in order to ease my life. So I usually use GitHub bots for many things, including dependabots, CVE, security, what else, really. But both because when we work on specific IBM or Red Hat product, we cannot really just use AI and think that the ownership of the source code should be shared between them, the AI bots, and us. So we can't always use AI, let's say. But this time, since an R&D project, and I didn't make the AI to write the source code, but helped me with the GitHub Action, all the other unrelated but still related to project management kind of task. I found it incredibly good, to be fair. So it has been a real pleasure to get helped on things like a GitHub Action, which I really like because they are useful, but I really hate to read the doc, find out how it works, and get up to date if something changed. That stuff is a solved problem to me thanks to AI. So that's why I wanted to say thanks, AI, because maybe one day will steal my job, but for now it's just helping me to get better.
So you used an agent to help you with the code, right?
Yes, I used the agent to help me with the code, to set up JRelease, to set up dev container, to make sure that dev container work correctly, because since it's an R&D effort, you cannot just use any OpenJDK release, for example. It doesn't work like that. It's using a very specific branch of JDK that is hosted in GitHub JDK Loom, is the Loom branch. And the Loom branch, you have to download it, compile it, and then you can write code on it or run things on it. But thanks God, Shipilev, Alexei Shipilev exists. So Shipilev has its own different build or the different JDK builds on a one-stop page. And it's publishing on a nightly basis a cut of the different Docker container images based on the build on its site. And in that way, I can leverage a dev container for Visual Studio Code or IDEA in order to ease the pain for developers to try things, and in order to make the GitHub Action to run on a nightly basis the test against the right container version with the right JDK version based on these images. So all this setup require to use very custom JDK builds. No.
Yeah, and because you need the build first before you can try it out, right? So you like,
exactly.
you would create a new Linux version and to test Linux, right?
Exactly. With Linux, it would be probably quite similar because you have to have a QEMU, for example. You need to have your images. So you download it and through QEMU, and then you can run even different architecture as well. Actually, we do like that for IOU Ring on Netty, for example, because if you have a Mac OS and you would like to try IOU Ring, how you can do it? You need to use some translation layer which enable that one to just work, unless you have Asahi Linux, but probably not many macOS users does it. So, and all this infrastructure part, in the past, I would take me quite a while because I have to read the docs, how to set up stuff. So in this case, having an agent on a very isolated and known, because there is a hell lot of documentation on the internet on how to do it right, make this kind of agents very effective. And it really lifted myself to know things that probably will be outdated in 20 days, very likely. So that has been a good experience to me so far. I tried with performance-related code, but we are not still there. So it's probably I used like Claude Opus 4.5 for performance.
Which is pretty good.
Code. Uh-huh. It is pretty good, but it just go nuts if it doesn't get it the first time. So that's the problem. But it's for the super hot path of application. So just if you're curious, I can tell you what was the task, because it was my Christmas task to have fun, because I love shooting myself in the foot during Christmas.
Okay. This is your old Christmas tradition, right?
Yeah, the, you know, the advent of code. For me, it's the advent of geeking more on performance. Doing things which in theory is super useful. So IP parsing. So, no, IP, you know how the IP, IPv4. IPv4 parsing, it should be fairly simple. But how to make it efficient? Why people think it's not efficient or how could be better? Now, the relative improvement by improving that part in an actual server is has yet to be decided. Maybe it's just a drop in the ocean. So for fun, I asked myself, okay, how could I make it better? What's wrong with that? And since HTTP 1.1, for example, allows you to parse characters, you don't receive a binary form, you have a stream of characters. But this character can interact during the parsing phase with the CPU in many subtle and different ways based on how you write the parsing code. So if you have to validate, for example, and during the validation phase you use a lot of branches, comparison, things like that, branches which are very well predictable usually are super fast on modern CPUs. And in theory, the purpose of a validation is exactly that one. So you validate, trying to optimize for the case in which it is valid, actually. No, so you don't care in that case of using comparison because usually they are well predicted. But for IP parsing, it's slightly different because you don't know how many digits you have for each part of the IP. It could be 3, 2, or 1, depending how it is written. So you can have 1 until 255. No, and while you're parsing, you have to find it when there is the dot. That operation to find if it's a number or is a dot require a variable. So you never know when it happens. And since you never
when
know...
When the dot comes, right?
Yes, when the dot is coming. And if the dot is not coming, is coming in the second or third or after 3 digits, you usually have some kind of switch to decide if is happening or an if, a comparison, to say, okay, this is not a digit, so it should be a dot. But that part is not well predictable because sometimes it could be that is a single digit, sometimes it's 2, sometimes it's 3. And the CPU doesn't know about it because in theory, you can parse things which is coming from every single part of the world. So you never know that information. And that part is what makes that one not efficient. Because every branch mispredict on modern CPUs can cost quite a lot of hundreds of cycles. And turning that thing into a mathematical operation which find the position, based on the position, decide what to do next, changes slightly the typical algorithm which I use to perform IP parsing. I try to suggest Opus to do it. So I know, I have an idea on how to do it with few math bit tricks, but I wanted to check if Opus was able to get there. Never. So it took me like 3 hours to convince it that was possible to do it. And at the end, I gave up and say, okay.
And probably, you also provided some context to Opus?
Yes.
Okay, like this is, you know, this is algorithms I know and whatever.
And you are a guy, you are a developer.
An expert in optimizations.
Yeah,
and
exactly. So I provide an high-level context of what how he's supposed to...
But this is like the system prompt, but it also provided, I don't know, links to some algorithms or...
Yeah, bit trick from the Stanford University and the Hacker's Delight books, which probably we talk about in some other context. So... I provide a few points to look at. I think that part won't work well because usually the people which goes that far into do fast IP parsing, they build a giant lookup table which can be query through vector instruction through the CPUs. And there are few papers on that. Probably if I would turn the problem into something which already have some literature on it, I think that Opus can do it. But what I was asking was a portable way to do it that doesn't use vector instruction, because I was using plain straight Java. And probably that's the part which Opus cannot get it, because I don't know how many samples even you can find on the internet, people that nuts to have done it. Or maybe it's useless, so why?
What I would attempt, because it seems like what the Opus was trained on the opposite, what you wanted to achieve, right? So what would be interesting is just to find similar concept from a different domain and tell Opus, look, this is my problem. I would like to solve the problem like that and provide him, you know, whatever suits your ideas. There should be something similar, absolutely independent from IP parsing, then it would work. Funny enough, I'm on the opposite part of the spectrum, because I'm a enterprise developer still, or even the startups are using more or less enterprise architecture. And whatever I do is very old. And what I found by accident, and I found it, I think, September, something like this, is that Opus is very well trained on the old patterns I know. And if you know the DSL, the lingo, I could be a prompt with a few words and it generates code which looks like my code. This is the incredible part. So it is.
That's great. Yeah.
This is great. So it means in my case, so I have specific architectures, like for instance, boundary control entity, which is older than UML. So there's lots of literature, and I also provided lots of examples which were parsed by Claude, because I asked him. I have a blog, you know, with 2,000 articles, and I was lucky, because whatever I did in my entire life as a Java developer, I always based my projects and architecture on standards. So not on my ideas, because I was I'm a lonely freelancer, and you cannot, you know, just compete with IBM, Red Hat, or others. So if I base on standards, so then we are talking, right? And this was a nice trick, because now the LLMs, of course, they know all the standards, because the standards were open and they were well trained on the standards. So what I'm doing right now in my projects, I'm thinking about providing the minimal information to the LLMs to generate the best possible code. And my idea is right now to write better code than I would, because what I'm experimenting with is, imagine to provide to Java enterprise application enough documentation, annotations, whatever possible, to have the perfect context. So if you open the project, you absolutely know what's going on. You know what I mean? With to the point Java doc, to the point package info, everything, you know, not, you know, documenting get and set as in opposite, just documenting the intentions. And this, interestingly, if you do this, this is perfectly readable for humans. But if you open that with whatever LLM you like, they also understand what you wanted to achieve, because the entire thing is based on standards. So it is interesting, because you are working now on cutting edge, which is not with just your ideas. It means the LLMs just were good in, you know, what they know, what they trained on, but there was not enough transfer knowledge, or they couldn't apply, you know, their reasoning skills to your problem. So the IP problem you had, this is not the native virtual scheduler.
No, actually. That one was my Christmas fun. While the other related, the native scheduler, is scheduler or scheduler, because that is,
I think,
the
scheduler,
debate.
Debate, yeah.
UK say, okay, scheduler, France, because we are not US. US people say, it's scheduler, don't worry. So I train myself to say scheduler, just because I mostly interact with the UK people.
Yeah, let's go with scheduler for the podcast.
Yeah, just because I train myself on that, not because it's actually, I think it's the right way. It looks more natural to me, scheduler, to be fair. So when it comes to the problem itself, so the problem statement for that, the high-level problem statement is that there are existing frameworks non-blocking frameworks based on event loops or very different models, mm-hmm. which allows people to interact with the networking layers like Tomcat, Jetty, or Netty is another example, but you can have many others, really. And all these frameworks are, at the very core, used in many other higher-level frameworks. That could be either Vertex, Quarkus, Webflux, Micronaut, or even other engines that are built on top of Jetty, for example, and Ktor. There are really a tons of different web frameworks application layers. All these web framework applications are really bound and tied to process stuff in their own worker pool when they have to call into the user code. So when the user provides its own code for the endpoint in order to provide what could happen if an HTTP request is coming or a message from JMS or whatever event, there is always a thread end-off mm-hmm. to another worker pool, unless you're making use of reactive programming. Because one of the idea of reactive programming, even if it's not built in, is more an implementation detail of it, is that if you have a reactive core in your application that could be either built on Vertex, Netty, or what else, and you are using on the user code reactive programming, you can leverage to make use of the same event loop of the actual underlying networking libraries without having this thread end off. The problem statement is that this behavior, which looks the more efficient way, could just be lost in translation when you're making use of virtual threads. Because if you would like to use, for example, blocking Hibernate, so a norm, or any existing blocking libraries built on JDBC or whatever, these libraries, blocks, since they block, they cannot be executed within the event loops, because one of the key rules of event loops is that event loop should never be stopped, right? Mm-hmm. Should never block. So because of that, you are forced to offload this running code to an external worker pool. This worker pool, from the perspective of virtual thread, is the underlying four-join pool, which actually is powering running the continuation, which represents the virtual thread created by user in order to perform some blocking operation.
It doesn't have to be four-join. It can be any thread you like, right?
In theory, right now you have just one option, which is the four-join pool. Mm-hmm. Part of the effort, which we are going to talk about, is to allow user to use others. Others including what else they write or existing one in the JDK primitive toolkit for executor service, for example. No? So the problem statement is this end off back and forth could be problematic from an efficiency perspective. And if you have a question about why it could be and under which cases, I can talk about it as well. So, because it's not given for granted. So when
give
I
me
talk
a worst
to people,
case. Give me a worst case.
Yes, yes. The worst case, and even at the same time, the common use case. Mm-hmm. The common use case is that you never get, in theory, a server which is fully loaded. So when it goes 100% CPU, that's not good, usually. Mm-hmm. No, that's not where you want to be. And you usually have a mild load. When you have a mild load and you have these two separate execution engine, it could be the event loop and the four-join pool, what happened from a mechanical sympathy perspective is that some I/O networking thing is going to wake up the event loop. Mm-hmm. The event loop will wake up, process whatever request has to be processed, and hand off the request to the other, to the worker for join pool. When that happens, if we are talking of a mild load, what happens is that you have to wake up the for join pool as well. When you wake up the FoJoin pool, it will wake up, it will pick the new virtual thread, it will execute it, whatever it is, including communicating with an external system. It could be a DBMS or PostgreSQL, MySQL, whatever, and it will go to sleep. When it will go to sleep, and the actual response is coming from the database, it's going to wake up again, right? Because something happened. The virtual thread can resume its work. And in order to send back the response to the actual HTTP client, it has to wake up again the event loop.
And it has to wake up because the thread is parked, right? So usually you would like...
If there is not much load...
It is going to be parked. Otherwise, we could keep the thread warm. But if we keep it warm, why we need virtual threads then, right?
CPU. Exactly. So this is the usual case when you don't have a huge amount of load. Since that networking activity tends to be bursty, because it is how it is, it's how the world works, usually you are wake up for enough to handle more than one request. So sometimes you amortize your cost to wake up and go to sleep. But the reality is that you have two systems which does it. Okay, in an ideal world, what happens if you have instead a single event loop? So we are talking about a single component, which doesn't need to communicate to an external FoJoin pool. Just do this thing for me. And so what happens? It doesn't have to wake it up, right? Because the event loop itself is already awakened. So you can just run the virtual thread code, eventually go to sleep, because it has to, or there is not much activity. And if something happens, it's going to be wake up from the database, because the response is coming, and it can straight on send to the networking layer what has to do without waking up again the event loop. So you're going to save a huge amount of wake up to sleep and sleep. That's one of the benefits. Waking up and going to sleep is like when you are driving a car. Cars are not optimized to start, stop, because every time you do it, you have a critical mass to be moved, and that one is going to waste a lot of energy and a lot of CPU cycle. It's going to harm the latencies, but not only. It's more about the bill on the cloud. That's going to cost a shitload of money.
Yeah.
So, and most of the system which ends off between the different thread pool stuff when they are not fully loaded, even if they can amortize stuff, they don't benefit as much as they could to amortize this waking up, because they are two. So you have mm-hmm. two different ones which can amortize for different two type of events. When you have one, clearly you increase by doubling your chances to amortize this wake up and parking. This is one of the reasons. The other reason is more tied to what the people does in these two different thread pool. So what could happen, but it really depends by the architecture and the framework. So we are talking about Quarkus because I know fairly well Quarkus, for example. What happened? So let's say that you have the FoJoin pool that is executing a virtual thread with an Hibernate call. When the Hibernate call complete, what happened? You probably have a bunch of entities. These entities could be detached out of the session, or it could be a projection, so they couldn't just be straight to be serialized into JSON or whatever, BSON or whatever format you would like to be sent across the wire through HTTP. But there is a serialization part in which that entities need to be serialized back into a binary or text form or whatever form. And then you have a bunch of byte arrays, let's say. Who is allocating those? Let's say that all these operations happen in the FoJoin pool. You have a huge byte array. This byte array is going to be sent to the event loop in order to make the event loop to send it to the wire. But that operation, from a mechanical sympathy perspective, means that if you have two cores and you are allocating memory in one of the cores, and the other one is the one responsible to read that memory, that memory is not hot in the cache, in the CPU cache of the receiver, the one that is supposed to send it across the network. So what happened is that you're going to use the last level cache of your CPUs in order to communicate a bunch of memory. It's very likely that if you are unlucky, this is going to eat the DRAM. Mm-hmm. And then there is three or four times more CPU usage spent in order to communicate, just send me this data, which is here, okay? That one is going to drain more power. And that's it. If you are making the two event loops, or the two thread pool to become one, what would happen on the other side is that you don't pay that cost because you are allocating one core, and that same core translated into the byte array, and that byte array is hot in the core, in the CPU, because it's there, and you can just send it across the wire without paying that one third of the cost that is supposed to be on the other side. So the whole purpose of the work that I'm doing together with Oracle, Oracle Labs, Netflix, there are a bunch of people from Alibaba, is to find a minimal Loom scheduler interface which enable user to write their own Loom scheduler or experiment with variation on the existing scheduler in order to enable improvement like this one. So this one is a huge improvement, if you can think about it. If you are curious about numbers, there is a Micronaut article written some time ago, which talk about the potential, not the potential, the real improvement they got by using this a variation of this scheduler, this netty scheduler, which enabled to have a single component which handled both the virtual thread and the networking layers, and they saved about 50% of CPU compared to not doing it. And in terms of latencies, they were getting similar latencies to the reactive use case. That clearly opened the door to few speculation about what would happen to the reactive libraries if this effort is going to land. And I'm not saying that it's going to kill reactive. I have no... The purpose of most of the talk that I'm doing...
I thought reactive's already dead with virtual threads, but...
Yeah, but still, there is a niche of there are a few cases.
I know. It was just, in my cases,
it's already solved fine, a lot of problems.
Is fine, yeah. But to recap, to understand the problem, is the problem you have is, let's say the entire life, we have a Quarkus with REST and Hibernate. So if you receive a request, the request, because there's some work involved, has to be received on a platform thread because there is a IO. And then a virtual thread happens. There's handoff to virtual threads. But then if you hit Hibernate, there's another platform thread. And your assumption is these both threads are not on the same core. And now we have, because the virtual threads, forget about that. This is nothing happens. There is just a logical concept, but there is no real OS work. Is nothing. It's just we can ignore this, I think, for performance reasons, right? So what we get at the end of the day, handoff between two threads, which in platform threads, so usual Java threads, which in worst case would run on two cores, right? So this is... And what you would like to optimize is to have one platform thread for the entire queue, so it's the processing pipeline. So you would like to receive, call Hibernate, and back by one platform thread, right?
Yeah, clearly, like anything, no? When you decide to pipeline, you became prone to head-of-line blocking because it is the life. No, it is what it is. How Loom solved that problem? Because even Loom, if you are just using Loom, you can still get it, no? If you have, let's say that you have a single core and you are using virtual thread, all the virtual thread run on the same core. So if you have a very long one that already take a lot of time to consume its CPU time and never block, this is going to delay all the others. That's an existing problem already with Loom. How the Loom people solve it is by using the four-join pool and hoping that you get more than one core. Because if you get more than one core, you have a work stealing. And with work stealing, you can expect, if the algorithm is sound, and usually it is, that the other platform thread of the four-join pool can steal from the head or the tail, I don't remember, probably the head, the next virtual thread that was waiting to be executed. So you don't have that head-of-line blocking problem unless you have it in both core. If you start to have it on both core, you still have it. With this effort about the custom scheduler built in order to work with the Netty, you can solve it in a similar way. So you can implement your work stealing algorithm, which is perfectly fine. But out of the box, for the existing existing library that I build, I haven't implemented it. For a good reason, because work stealing is probably one of the most complex optimization to make right. Like CPU scheduling,
because but it sounds easy, right? So this is like
it's sounds super easy.
So there's like threads. There you give tasks to a thread, and if a thread has nothing to do, it just goes
we'll
to the.
It.
No, this it was not exact, right? There are multiple work queues, and on the queues there is one thread which processes the tasks, and if one thread has nothing to do, it's allowed to steal the work from the other queues, right? This is what happens behind this.
Exactly. The theory is that, whoa, it's super easy. Let me just do it. But the problem with that is that you don't know the future. I mean, you can't predict how faster it would be if that same task would remain where it is. So the only way to do it right, and is right, is never right. The way in which you can do it better is do something similar to what CFS does. So CFS is the first scheduler into Linux. You got definitely a couple of tricks that cannot be done right now on the Loom scheduler, like you could preempt stuff regardless what they are doing. So that stuff is not just possible at the moment, even if there is a branch of Loom which can do it. That's interesting. But regardless, in the existing states, the preemption happens on specific yield point within the JDK libraries when blocking code is going to block and park a virtual thread. So under these cases, since you don't know the future, like CFS, you can check for from a queue, which one of the other core got the longest run queue in which the last task was standing for longer, and which one of the cores exhibit a too high utilization. And then you are going to help it, because if it has a chronicle history of having super high utilization and you have a task which is sitting there for longer, you can get, you have enough confidence to say, okay, let me help it. Because in this case, we know that probably it really need my help. But this kind of algorithm, which looks super, I mean, they are always based on some heuristic, let's say, is not purely mathematical because you never know the future, as I told you. So in that case, they could work pretty bad, because just thinking, collecting, monitoring can make things to slow down. And indeed, the four-join pool doesn't apply any specific optimization for work stealing. It just do it. And that could be problematic, because if you have a very good craft code, which is very efficient, unless you have a queue of waiting 10K virtual thread, probably it's not worth it to work still, especially if you are on the cloud, because one of the purposes of the Netty scheduler that I build is exactly to stick to the core. Because when you are on the cloud, maybe you are making use of a Graviton machine, because it's super cheap. It costs way less than AMD and other alternatives. It's slightly slower, but the topology of this CPU, it's a mess. They have a huge amount of cores. These cores are grouped into sockets. Sockets, there are quite a lot, a bunch of them. And these sockets have like a ring buffer, a ring to communicate between each other. So you never know at which point you are in the ring when you communicate to the wrong one. You can get a huge distance, as costly as network call, just to get the information from the other cores. So if you try to help someone and you get it so much slower, that is better for you to wait. Maybe it's not a good idea to help it. So in these cases, if you're going to use an empty scheduler that I built, you will get a huge performance boost. So on the cloud, it could be literally a game changer in terms of CPU usage. And, you know, if one of the selling points of using the existing non-blocking React libraries is to make things more efficient, is one of the selling point, then you can say, okay, maybe with this effort, that specific point won't hold anymore. Now, rethinking what the Reactive Manifesto is not just that part. It's about back pressure, it's about
resilience. What occurred to me is about the work stealing, that this is actually an interesting architecture which eliminates load balancer. So forget about the scheduler, but actually you could implement a cluster of quarkuses with work stealing without having a central point of failure, right?
Yeah, if you assume that when you steal, you perform in an idempotent way. Because the problem when you are within the same machine, stealing is as costly as stealing a reference. So there are ways to do it in a
reliable from the logical perspective. Is interesting that work stealing, there's no central point of failure, because there is no a single coordinator, load balancer coordinator. It's just the threads are communicating with each other. It's more like peer-to-peer concept almost.
If you are on the same VM, I think so. But if you are across the network,
it costs that too high, right? Mm-hmm.
That's the problematic part. Because when you say, okay, I want to steal your task, you mm-hmm. still need a formal distributed consensus or some coordinator which say, okay, that task really has been stolen. No? Mm-hmm. Because if not, you can risk that the other was just blocked, the other quarkus instance. And when it wake up, it looks at the state of that task. It doesn't get an agreement on what's the state of the task. And you get that task to be executed into both. So you need to have or idempotent task, or you need to have consensus while deciding what could be the actual executor for that specific mm-hmm. task. That's as an high level, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. Would be resilient.
Above resilience, not performance, it's more like resilience. But I just interrupted you regarding the manifesto, Reactive Manifesto.
Yeah, I mean, one of the crucial, the crux of building something which is going to steal the light from one of the good features that Reactive was bringing in the end of the people is that few people told me, okay, so this is going to kill Reactive, right? And my answer has been, I don't think so. I think it's a different thing. So I think that the Reactive Manifesto stated clearly what was the purpose behind the Reactive, including the back pressure stuff, the resiliency. So all these capabilities are still required. And the Reactive libraries are built in a non-blocking way because that was what the language provided at that time. No? And that was forcing a huge mess of complication when it comes to understanding the stack traces, because stack traces are no longer meaningful, because you have to rewrite things as simple as a for loop into something which became a DSL. because you don't have assistance from the language, from the platform, in order to do it. In Scala, you can do things maybe slightly different, but the point is that you have to rethink a lot of stuff because you cannot block. But if you can block and you still need back pressure, and you need to compose operation on streams, and you would like to do all these things together, there is nothing in Java. Or better, there is nothing yet in the built-in primitives of Java. Even structured concurrency suggests you to use primitives like semaphore or other similar ways if you want to apply back pressure. But that's not a reactive back pressure because it tells you just to block. It doesn't tell you what I could do if I can't block. So it's block or not block. And if you need to time the block and you react because the time is not expired, you can't. So, it's not that it's missing something. That's a different level of abstraction. And many high-level users consider dealing with the primitives of Java not easy. And it's not Java fault, because users is a word which bring a lot of weight. There are framework writers, which are developers, and they are users of Hotspot. But there are back-end developers which are good in that, and they are similar to framework writers because they write even extension libraries, so they are fairly low level. And there are super high-level users which love to put annotation and just open for the best. When it comes to all different degrees of developers, just saying, okay, you can just use executor service. They have never done it before. Why they should do it now? Mm-hmm. And it's not the library fault. The library provides what's best in order to ease the life of what's so-called average user. But when you have such different percentiles of users, the average doesn't make any sense, right? So it depends who you are. Mm-hmm. And you would like to provide maybe an higher level abstraction libraries, which is similar to Go, in which you can block because you have channels, right, to communicate.
So this is what I wanted to ask. So oversimplifying, the solution to the problem would be a kind of a session where you are assuming you are always two I/O parts which require platform threat. If we would be able to mark the incoming, so something comes in, is always the case. We have an actor and there's an event coming in. And we say, look, you are working now on the core number one, and this would be the session, the marker, whatever. And then on the other side, we would like to have a platform thread which runs on the core one. If we would be able to do that, then the problem would be solved, right?
And clearly, in all of this, with a fancy, easy API in order to deal with that, because that's the other problem. Mm-hmm. No, so as I said, so the old statement is we need to make things more efficient because it's a waste as they are. But by making them more efficient by leveraging some new API within Hotspot in order to make you write your own custom scheduler, that just for your information is like 200 lines of code. Mm-hmm. Is not that complex.
Five classes. I just opened your project right now.
It's really small. And a lot of that is boilerplate in order to adapt what really netty require. It's not because of requirement on the Loom side. On the Loom side, the decision are made in very few points and tends to be decently simple. So if you're curious, I can explain high level what it does, because as I said, it's not that complex really. Mm-hmm. It's more complicated because it has to deal with existing libraries like Netty, but probably in Jetty you would do something similar, because I had few conversations with Simone Bourdet, which one of the lead of Jetty, and he say, Franz, just finish this one, release it, we are going to take basically the whole API, so put it on the Apache. And then we are going probably to do exactly the same with Jetty, because we have a fairly similar requirement with Servlet, in which the servlet written by users would like to block. And you would like to protect the users while running this stuff, and how you can do it. Just use virtual 12, because you can block safely without causing a massive performance problem.
And but we are talking now about the repository Netty Virtual Thread Scheduler, and this is on your this is the project and the repository, and your username is France1981. So if someone would like, you know, to take a look at the project, it's France1981. I will put it in the show notes as well. And the name of the repository is netty-virtualthread-scheduler or scheduler.
Yeah.
So it depends now.
Yeah, it's, on your location. You know, it's up to you.
Exactly. So, and what are you doing exactly?
So what it does, it's the whole effort in itself is made of pairing with the Oracle Loom team in the form of Victor Klang, Alan Bateman, Andrew Haley, and we got some meetings with Ron Pressler. That doesn't mean that it's going to be released on JDK. That's important. It's a communication with them in order to find what's the minimal API which could be exposed by Hotspot in order to help the people to write something which is useful and to experiment. When we talk about experiment, we're talking about this thing we have talked so far, or for other things like deterministic testing. So let's say that you would like to write a test which you control the execution of the different tasks to a scheduler. How you can do it? You can't on the for join pool because you have no control on what the scheduler is doing. But if you create your own scheduler, which is basically saving everything into a queue, you can decide the order of the different things. You can pick into it. And that improves, from a testing perspective, what could be done on virtualthread as well. So one of the purposes of the custom scheduler API is not just to write more efficient scheduler, is to enable user to experiment with ideas, including improving the test coverage for the existing Loom project. So it's not just for that one. And as I said, it's a work in progress thing. Right now, what you have to do is to provide a single system property, which it will point to a class that is within the project itself, which just creates a singleton that is the actual coordinator of all the whole scheduling of virtualthread and will be sucked within the JDK itself and consider the main scheduler for Loom. So it means that the life cycle of this singleton will last as the whole duration of your hotspot virtual machine. Once you get that, the way by which has been implemented is to offload the actual decision to which real Netty scheduler offload a virtual thread only if the virtual thread is started by using a specific thread factory. So we do have thread factory which are attached to specific platform thread, and you can declaratively use those virtual thread factory to create executor service, create a structured concurrency scope, and then you know that all the thread, the virtual thread created through these different meanings are bound to run on specific platform thread, which are hosted together with the Netty event loop virtual thread. So that means that if you are within Netty, for example, Netty handle a specific event, and that event lead to call into the user space, the user code, which is going to create a new virtual thread. That virtual thread, if it's using the right factory, is going to run on the same platform thread of Netty itself. And the scheduler is just making sure that this is going to happen, together with other interesting concurrency issue, which I never thought about before, which are very interesting. Like, for example, Adam, you mentioned the run queues for scheduling. So that because it's how they are made. So both CFS and the four join pool, they have queues of tasks which are supposed to run, and each core have their own dedicated run queue. The same architecture is what I built for this scheduler. But what I was thinking, since I'm the guy behind the JC tools, everything is just a queue. Not really, because the life cycle of the four join pool is imminent. Four join pool, when it's within hotspot, it's never shut down, right? Mm-hmm. So since it's never shut down, you know for sure that a virtual thread, let's say that have a timeout sleep of 1 year. If you keep for 1 year that virtual machine opened, eventually this is going to run, right? That's simple. But let's say that you have a native event loop scheduler. The event loop scheduler, since they are bound to Netty itself, in test, for example, they tend to be created and closed. What happens if it's closed? That's a problem, because the people are used to have the same guarantees with the four join pool. So if something is supposed to run eventually, it has to run, right? So what you will do as a developer, what I decided to do there is to create a new queue, which has been named differently because I prefer stream, which represents the run queue of the task, the virtual thread, which are supposed to run on a specific platform thread in the scheduler. And when the scheduler closes, it initiates a shutdown procedure which closes the stream. So if there is a racy submit to the stream, but the stream has already been closed, what happens is that the virtual thread is going to be offloaded to the existing four join pool in order to guarantee that it will complete. So I gave up on the ability in order to make sure that the sync progress guarantee that you got on Loom are respected by making use of this new scheduler. And there are tasks for that. So it's been a really entertaining kind of thing. So it's not just a proof of concept, it's production grade. So it's solving problem which usually you will get in test, in production, with custom class loader and things like that. So,
but the key idea is that the threat factories are creating threats with specific characteristics, which could be one threat which is bound to a core. And you schedule it, picks the, just provide us the right virtual threat. No, sorry, the threat factory, and which will create the threat. And this is the optimization, right? And because I could implement my own test virtual threat factory and then mock it or do whatever, and then I have more control and can use your scheduler for testing as well.
Exactly. And this decision has been made thanks to the Oracle Loom team, because initially, since I'm coming from Quarkus, and that's a problem in this case, because we want to help too much people sometimes. So in my brain, I said, okay, let me do super magic. I would like that when you are in the Netty event loop, automatically, when you create a virtual thread, this is going to run exactly on the same event loop platform thread, magically, without any intervention. So it means that whatever existing code will just work fine without being declarative about where you want to run what. And I was thinking it was a great idea. But when I talk with the Oracle Loom people, exactly Victor and Alan, they have been great because they get immediately what the problem was, which I wanted to help people. And they told me, Franz, really, think about it. If you have an Oracle or what else, JDBC library, which create a reaper virtual thread lazily, only when class loading happens, that's a problem. Because let's say that you have this reaper JDBC to check if connection virtual thread long running, which check for leaky connection. You don't want that one to execute on the event loop thread. But sadly, because of the class loading, it's going to be triggered exactly the first time that the one code is running there. So you get unlucky and you get attached to the wrong one. So be declarative, even if it imply an additional operation for users. Because the reality is that most users, at least on Quarkus, will just look at the annotation run on virtual thread. And it's the framework which take care to provide the context where you would like things to be executed. So they won't notice this additional
operation. Absolutely. And if someone would even do more on Quarkus, I would consider this a defect because, you know, chances are high there's like pre-major optimization or unique snowflake, whatever. So what I do in code reviews, I insist that they only use, you know, either no, completely rely on conventions, and if necessary, just, you know, the micro-profile annotations and not too much stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. So thanks to the interaction with them, I got the existing form of the API, which is fairly minimal. And even for existing framework writer like Vertex, adopting the scheduler I made is a one line. Mm-hmm. Because it doesn't require anything. It's just, okay, you got the same API of Netty. You can use the same transport and you can just use this factory to create your own executor service. You can put a semaphore there if you really need it. It's your choice. Mm-hmm. And in theory, if this effort would lend to having good performance because the people tried it out, then we have more chances that is going to be actually exposed into a JDK mainline. Mm-hmm. The current API surface is very minimal. I'm talking about even the JDK one for the scheduler. So the scheduler in itself is two methods, on start and on continue. That's all. Mm-hmm. The other thing is the so-called virtual thread task, which allows to attachment to the virtual thread continuation. And the attachment part is the key part because in the attachment, you can write to which scheduler actual real platform thread that you would like to run stuff. So there is where you're going to put your decision about scheduling. In order to make that part to be reliable, clearly you have to deal with the module opening and stuff like that, mostly because you don't want normal user to be able to pick into the task. No, clearly. And that could be for the future, even a game changes when it comes for observability. Because if you have this additional context attached to a virtual thread, you can provide an easy way, for example, to monitor the state changes of virtual thread when they run within the scheduler. Because from the perspective of the scheduler, a virtual thread is a non-blocking task. So actually, it's the under-the-hood behavior of virtual thread. So when you run a virtual thread, it's like any other runnable. And when you run it and it will fully execute, it could be in a few different states. It could have been completed or it could be waiting on some resources because it has been parked. But from the perspective of the scheduler, it's a non-blocking task. So in theory, you can capture into this attachment the state or the change of the state, and you can provide information about the scheduler decision and what's going on with different virtual thread, assuming that they have some context ID, which usually they have with OpenTelemetry, for example. So there are many, many good things to have an open custom scheduler API, even for observability. So it's not just...
This is a mental exercise. What I could even do with your scheduler then, I could get rid of virtual threads entirely and just run, you know, my own tasks without virtual threads, right? Because you said from the perspective of the scheduler, a virtual thread is a non-blocking task. So I could have a non-blocking task and just let it execute by your scheduler, right?
Yes, but in that case, you can just use Netty. Because
I'm just, you know, from the abstraction perspective.
Mm-hmm. Ah, yes, it is as simple as treating things like that. The only thing is that you have to honor the virtual thread task interface because the virtual thread task interface during the execution, they just need to be runnable. You don't need anything more. But during the routing to decide who is going to run them, you need, for example, the attachment information, but only there. And there is another thing which I made it, which horrified completely the Oracle Loom team, but was pretty effective and necessary in that case, that is so-called thread local scoped value. Because scope value in their own nature are scoped. So it means that could be inherited and overridden based on a lexical scope. That's how they work. But sometimes you would like something as efficient as a scope value that is basically just speaking into a stack to the top of the stack related to that specific thread. So it's like reading a field on a virtual thread, let's say. It's not really like that, but it's a good mental model. And at the same time, you want it that should be exactly for that thread. In short, a very fast thread local. Mm-hmm. In my case, I needed something like that. But scope value is too wide for my purpose. So I implemented on top of it a sort of thread local scope value. And it's there.
It should be thread local scope values, right? So you want thread local could have multiple scoped values, right?
Yeah, basically. So,
yeah, okay.
And that is saving one of the biggest problem which I observe in the last 2-3 years. And I'm not joking because it looks like a stupid things, but it's really, it's not on the existing framework, including Micronaut, Quarkus, Spring, Open Liberty. All this framework require often for observability to have a context which is floating around and communicate stuff. This kind of stuff are always or very often implemented through thread local. Thread local, when you are in a worker thread, you never know when that worker thread is gone. No. Mm-hmm. And or better, you don't know when you are in the context, when it's gone. And you would like to make sure that after being propagated the context, you would like to not make it available and leak into that thread because you don't know what's the life cycle of that thread. You don't know if it's going to live forever. So the risk is that you can leak the entire class loader of whatever is leaked into that thread. So usually what the people does is to call threadlocal.remove. Mm-hmm. Threadlocal.remove is under review and improvement coming from Alexei Shipilev on Hotspot because he's making use of soft reference queues. So not only it has a performance problem with the GC because it's not intrinsified, so it's not optimized well from Hotspot. It has a problem of scalability because the reference queue tends to be the same. So if you have a thread local dot remove on different thread, on the same thread local, they will create a scalability issue between each other. Not many
what
people
I had in projects is they used developers laughed back then, used thread local instead of request scope, and they forgot to invoke remove, so they stored more and more data. And in one project, this was interesting because what they leaked was the key, and the key was long. This is bad because we saw the memory leak after a few days, you know, because long was still small and we need to know a huge amount of longs to see that. And after a while, the project stopped with out of memory error. And the problem was missed remove invocation. So in my project, in enterprise code, I actually don't like to see thread local because it's a low level construct. In your case, it makes absolute sense. This is like, you know, it is attaches something to a real thread. And your construct is actually interesting because you have a thread local, which keeps the relation to the platform thread. And in there, you could have scoped values, which are addressed for virtual threads, right?
Yeah. So, and as you said, the same for me. If I would work on more higher level kind of code, and I see a thread local, I will ask at least 10 times more why Really, yeah. Why are you sure about it? I mean, you think it's easy. It's easy to get into a mess with that stuff. And not because it's just primitive. The primitive obsession is one of the problems with many developers. But that is a separate thing. Here it's really more about you don't know what you are going to do because you can't expect to have control of the life cycle or whoever is running you. And especially if we are talking about framework threats. No. So in this regard, the framework writer, which I, as we said, is a different breed of developer, is still a developer, but is fairly low level developer, still require some mechanism for that. And that mechanism based on thread local remover create a massive performance issue as well. So we are in a situation which we would like to use something else. And what the virtual thread attachment provide, or together that other thread local scope value, it could be a good and nice different perspective in order to avoid that problem, which even if it's going to be intrinsified and solved by ship level, still create other performance issues. Because, for example, thread local, beside being not immutable, beside being mutable, which is a problem, have another problem, which is that it has to create lazily a whole thread local map. That part means a huge allocation. Virtual threads, in theory, are supposed to be quite cheap to be created. But if you create a thread local with them, you're going to create a further allocation. Usually you would say, I mean, who cares? In Java, we allocate quite a lot. Yes, but it would be better for you to allocate for good reason. Because if there is not much reason for that, just because you want to pass the context around, probably you're going to waste, again, on the cloud, quite a lot of memory. And the memory is just part of the story because GCs always have an hidden cost. That hidden cost, it's imminent in the whole duration of a runtime because someone has to clean up your mess if you're going to create many of those. And could be problematic if you want to keep more constrain your environment, which often happen on the cloud because we are talking about 2, 3, 4 cores kind of instances. So maybe it's not the worst thing, but if you are a framework writer, you don't want that one because your framework libraries are supposed to live together with the user code. And the user code is already a mess most of the time. So at least you don't want to be a noisy neighbor to it. Mm-hmm. So
perfect. Are we covered, native virtual scheduler?
Yeah. Let's hope for the future, at least. With the new here, we have a bunch of other experiment to do. There is a thing called Polar, which is the internal behavior of a virtual thread to handle blocking I/O in a way that looks blocking but is not really blocking, which is leveraged by the custom scheduler in order to further boost the performance.
I would just reinvite you back or you ping me if there's something new experiment. And I always enjoy, you know, the discussion because it's good to know what happens, you know, below my interfaces. So this is the work behind the interfaces, exactly. I use Quarkus all the time, but I rely on MicroProfile usually. It's really interesting what happens inside, right?
That's great. Many thanks, Adam. It's been a pleasure for me as well, as usual.
And France, 1981, and forked France everywhere else, right?
Yep, exactly.
Forked underscore France on Twitter, I think, and France 1981 on GitHub.
A lot of France.
Lots of too France. Much. And and people should, from on the GitHub repository, create issues or contact you directly with feedback because I know you're absolutely open for feedback. So thank you. It was a pleasure, really.
Many thanks. See you.
See you.